This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 42, Chunking Your Year. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we talk about what kind of training works best at different times of year. We often talk about different training methods, but we don't necessarily talk about when they can be used to their best effect. So this show puts that right. We also answer your questions about having the intention to score even when you're looking to survive as a batsman and a batting team, and how do you deal with very bouncy indoor nets if your outdoor games are not bouncy at all? Find out on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome again to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This, as you probably already know, is your guide to better cricket, playing it or coaching it. My name's David Hinchliffe. I'm here to help you, and also here to help you are two cricket coaches, the first of which is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Mealfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garrus.
How are you? Are you okay?
Yeah, very good, thanks. And secondly, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, David. All well?
Yes, welcome all. Welcome, listeners and presenters. Right, let's start the show by talking about training. Here in the UK, of course, we're in winter training mode. It's getting wetter and darker and colder every day, it seems like, anyway. So we're doing a lot of indoor training. And I was thinking about this and thinking about how doing different types of training at different types of year, different times of the year, I should say, influences players' performance when it comes to the summer. So is there any types of training that you do more of at some time of the year, and any types of training that you would stay away from at other times of the year?
Well, I think it's something that you have a sort of outline plan at the start of the year, but you have to be keen to shift that plan according to what's faced in front of you, you know, what the players do and how they're progressing. Sometimes you have to accelerate that plan. Sometimes you have to go back a little bit on that plan. So never become a slave to any program or plan that you've got in place. But, you know, the basic parameters for me at this point of the year, which is just started our winter development phase, is really to look at last year to assess the areas that you want to develop. And some areas that you want to make into greater strengths, and really to attack those in a drill-based scenario sense. So a lot of underarm feeds, a lot of throwdowns, a lot of isolating certain things. So, for example, we've got a couple of kids doing some work on the short ball and trying to present a better option when they deal with it in the summer. So initially we're working on some isolated drills, a lot of ramp drills that you may have seen in the articles that I've written, just to get more balls in that area so they can develop a response which is more appropriate than what they've had previously, whether it's to get out of the way of it, whether it's to be able to take it on. We also do have one opportunity per week in this phase of the year for the players to compete with each other. And the reason why I've put that in is really to based on their feedback as much as anything else over the years. We used to go very into isolated drill stuff and very much one-to-one based solely in this part of the year. And the feedback that I've had from the players is that occasionally I'd like to let off some steam and have a go at each other. And that's really what that 1 hour a week is about, really competing against each other. And if they want to, try and see if the skills that they're developing in their one-to-one sessions go over into a match context, or the closest to matches that we can get at this time of year, which is obviously a net. But those nets will be ramped up more in the second part of the year, which is January to March, than they are presently in this phase of the year, which is more about building skills, really, or trying to deal with a problem that they had last year and have a better solution for when they go into the season in April.
Levis, do you find that there's any types of training that you naturally stay away from at different times of the year?
There probably are. I'm usually thinking about what I'm wanting to do rather than what I'm wanting not to do, if that makes sense. Yeah. But we're similar in our sort of layout to Gareth's. So we don't get too caught up in the kind of the match play scenario stuff at this stage, although we're trying to have, we're actually doing one session a month, so we don't actually get as much time as Gareth is managing to implement into his program. But once a month now through November and December, we'll be bringing the boys back together where they can have a bit of a fight in a net, which will be fun. Things we stay away from, unfortunately, we don't get a load of fielding done before Christmas. We get some catching done, but we don't get a lot of fielding. But that's probably just because of the space we have available and the lack of creativity of me in using it. And the time available
to have. Isn't it? To get in.
Yeah, we do a bit of catching. We do some basics and on that, but it's not necessarily the space we have, but it's the space combined with the time availability as well. And we generally prioritise catching when it comes to fielding over anything else. So we can get some catching work done inside, which is nice. But apart from that, we'll generally stick to the core skills around bowling, batting. And wicket keeping at this stage, which we'd like to do more, but we then crack on it when we get after Christmas. We kind of get stuck into the field and we get a good probably 3 months of hard work on that side before the season starts.
One classic training method is using the bowling machine, of course, and that can be sticky. There are different people who, as you wrote once, Gareth, I think it's like Marmite, you love it or you hate it. But there are times of the year when you would use it more and times of the year that you would use it less?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. I'd probably use it more this phase, so this first phase, you know, because what you do get with the bowling machine is consistency in feeding it into an area. That was its primary thing, I suppose, when it was first put into operation many moons ago. So, for example, if you're practicing back foot drives or you want to be able to work on playing pull shots, for example, you can get a consistent number of balls in those areas that sometimes our throwing or our bowling or our feeding doesn't necessarily provide us with, although I always challenge every coach to get good at their delivery skills so they can throw and bowl into space, because it does make it more realistic to what you're going to get in the game. The other thing that we've been doing a lot of is using one of the fielding machines, and people that have read the articles may have seen this over the last few weeks, and we'll see it again in the next few weeks. The fielding machines pinging the balls into spaces and also onto ramps as well, which has been really valuable practice for the guys, and certainly a number of technical developments have been made and been seen in those open sessions where bowlers do bowl against the batters as a result of the work that we've done in isolation on those fielding machines. So if you do have one, and ours actually was a hockey delivery machine rather than a fielding machine, which is if you do have one, then you know, watch this space for some drills that you can use with them, because they are valuable at delivering balls into spaces to build up that repetition, I suppose, and to build those skills. So I'm a bigger fan of them in this phase, and I would be necessarily going into the later phases and into the season, although I do recognise that some players really like bowling machines and some players don't, as you said, David.
Can I just add something to that, Gareth, which we have three bowling machines, which are bowler ones, and they're brilliant, and we use them regularly at this time of the year, pre-Christmas. There's a lot of workload on them. What we do with the use for the fielding machine type thing is, we don't actually have a fielding machine, but what we did for some reason is we had four sets of legs and three bowling machines. So we got the tech department to chop up one of the legs into nine little bits, and now we've got nine short legs and nine long legs.
Perfect.
So rather than spending another £400 or whatever it would cost, you just chop one leg up if you can, and you've got a little mini low bowling machine which you can swivel and do what you want with.
One of our players says that he can use just a normal bowling machine, just take the legs off, and I can use it as a fielding machine. You know, I can feed it no problem off my thighs. I've not tried that. I'm a bit scared of doing that.
Yeah, I think
it's just the lack of stability there, really.
And you need him to get him to sign a disclaimer, David. So when his thighs get injured, or when something goes wrong, or he misfires it into his foot, that would be a good one, wouldn't it? It won't be your fault. I like the way that Sam has worked there. I've also seen people, mostly in schools actually, because we do have these technical departments and woodworking departments. I've seen somebody put together a base which has been made up of wood and by a cabinet maker, which has enabled them to use the head of a normal bowling machine as well. I'm getting better at using these things, and I'm finding more versatility in how those lower delivering bowling machines can be used. And Graham Thorpe's opened my eyes a little bit to that. But again, you don't want to get overused to that type of stuff, because you want to make it functional and you want to get people eventually throwing and bowling into the same spaces and seeing if those responses become automated, rather than when you're on a bowling machine, sometimes they just happen because you know the ball's going to be there. So the ability of batting is always being able to make a good decision and then be able to execute off the back of it.
That is the beauty of the low machine onto the ramp, isn't it? Where there's an element of control on the coach's part, but there's still that indecision on the batter's part, which is what you want, and that's what you're trying to train.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm actually looking at trying to design something along the, you know, the catch it ramps, because obviously we're using those at the moment, and you get the deviation in terms of you know, they might flick off, and like a leg cutter, they might go straight, they might yep. like, go like an off cutter. But also I'm looking at trying to develop something where the catch it ramp goes at different heights, so rather than it deflecting and going laterally, trying to get something that goes at slightly different heights. And when I say slightly, I mean, you know, you might get a ball that goes into a backward defensive shot as opposed to one flying at your head, but having the ability to go off of the same type of length in two different heights that you're receiving it at, and I think will be quite useful as well, particularly for keepers. So a keeper standing up, you know, the ball goes into length. Sometimes it will go through at stump high, and sometimes it will kick up and go through at shoulder height. So trying to work at that at the moment, because I'm really, really enjoying these fielding machines at the moment.
I've actually got one of my catch-it boards, which I've got two big rubber bands around.
Yeah.
And that's quite good at just changing, it almost takes the pace off a little bit and just changes the trajectory slightly. It's not a product that anyone would want to buy or anything like that, but it's just a different way of using the same thing. It's one of the big rubber bands from the gym.
Wait, are they horizontal or vertical?
I've got one of each, so just in a cross.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Yeah, right. Like a cross.
Yeah.
What about where the sidearm fits into all that? Is there a more preferential time of year for the sidearm?
I wouldn't say necessarily so, because if you get good at delivering the sidearm, then you can utilise it in all manner of ways. And what we've done now, because we've had quite a big focus with three or four lads on their back foot game, is I've got one of our coaches is brilliant at throwing at a slower pace, but he's either throwing it into length, half volley, or for the pull shot now, because I'm trying to get them to develop after this isolated practice of being able to pull a ball and leave it effectively with it flying around their ears. Also then to have a capacity to go back into it when it's randomised, because obviously that is batting. So even at slightly slower paces now, I'm getting him to bowl to throw it around 60, 65 miles an hour, which isn't fast by any stretch of imagination. But I'm looking to see whether that isolated practice can be then taken into an open environment. Because what you tend to find is that people, when they're playing on bowling machines, will just almost be moving before the ball's bowled because they know where it is. Whereas as soon as you get somebody sidearming at you, you've got to be able to go from your stance, and then move from your stance into whatever stimulus is coming towards you, whether it's length ball, half volley, or a short ball. So we're using isolating like that. Then as soon as we get into January, February, March, obviously we'll be ramping up the pace a little bit to see whether it stands up as soon as you add a little bit of pace in. But the sidearm to me is something that you can be using all year, because it's the closest thing we can get really to somebody bowling at us. And it's just about changing the intensities of it and having a real focus to why you're using it. And at the moment, Dan's doing some amazing work at just changing the lengths to see whether this isolated practice goes into an open, randomised environment as well.
Do you ever have any deviation between bowling and throwing with the sidearm as well?
Do I have any what? Sorry. Just...
Do you ever deviate between bowling the sidearm and throwing the sidearm? Because often with the bowling, obviously, you get a little bit of extra height out of it, some people get more control with one or the other. But I do find that sometimes with the younger guys, when they're first moving on to a sidearm on a specific skill that they're trying to develop, I sometimes will go with a throwing technique, which just takes a little bit of the extra bounce away. and then move into the full bowling action, which is what I'd prefer to do normally.
When you're looking to introduce somebody to sidearm, because it is different, isn't it? You know, as much as it's the closest thing to a bowler bowling, it does take some adjustment because you've got to get used to the difference in timings and, as you say, the difference in height. And the starting point, if you can get it to throw in, then it comes from a lower release point, which makes it probably easier to start that journey. So now I think you're onto something there. Good interjection there.
What kind of level of accuracy would be acceptable, I suppose, is the word? How good can you get in a short amount of time, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, my own experience and what I watch of the guys is that initially you've got no idea where it's going.
Yeah.
And I would always encourage people to practice first without a batter being in place. And when I say practice, I mean have three or four goes at it of a reasonable amount of time. So you are practicing your skill. And effectively, when they can deliver into a space where it isn't going to be either overly short all the time or beamers all the time, then I'm happy for them to start throwing at each other. It's that beamer ball that is the one that just does come out with a sidearm if people haven't practiced it, which is the real shocker. But as soon as they can go from bouncer into half volley, even if they're not meaning to throw the half volley and they're trying to throw length, you know, that's what happens in a game, isn't it? Because people don't mean to bowl half volleys very often, yet they do come out. So, you know, that's pretty much my starting point. But until they can not bowl a beamer, until they can not just hoof it halfway down the pitch, I'll keep them practicing in the net on their own, and then I'll take them forward. So, but the randomisation of it is brilliant. That's the fantastic bit. So whilst, you know, Sam and myself haven't thrown millions of these things now, and Steve Wilson at our school, who is an absolute master on them, can get to a stage where you try and throw a Yorker, it comes out every time. You try and bowl a half volley, it comes out every time. You know, the randomisation is absolutely brilliant. So I encourage it, and I'm sure Sam does the same, for the kids to get really good at it, because it means that they can be practising some good things even when our backs are turned, you know.
It's so useful, isn't it, having another, out of nowhere, you've got another genuine quick bowler who doesn't have to run and isn't going to get exhausted, but adds a massive amount to a session for you. And it frees you up a little bit as well to do what you want to do, which may be coaching, it may not be, you never know.
It also gives the guys that are just batters, it gives them the opportunity to contribute to a practice rather than it just being about their own development. And sometimes you get that from the guys who are purely there to catch or to bat or a combination of those two, that they forget that actually, you know, the nets and the practice sessions are about the team going forward, and it involves them a little bit more in that process, which I think is only valuable to their members of the team.
I actually remember just a brief sort of story. I remember going to Western Australia when I was 18 and I was playing at Willetton Cricket Club, and the throwing that the guys had was incredible, because if unless you were a bowler and you were likely to be involved on the weekend in that role, you were having your bat and then you were going down in the other nets and you were having throwdowns for probably 40 minutes before and after you'd had your bat, and you'd be in pairs and you'd do 20 or 30 at a time, whatever, then you'd swap it over and you'd keep rotating. But the strength and the accuracy of their throwing as a result of that was incredible, and no doubt they do a similar thing these days with a sidearm, but it prolongs the amount of opportunities for development that guys are getting.
Okay, good. Let's wrap up this discussion with a yes-no round then. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more that the team want to say. I've got the question, so let's fire away. First question. Banter is often a way to hide poor behaviour.
Yes.
Second question. Managing training is about time, focus, and energy.
No.
Third question. Everyone needs rituals.
No.
This is the portion of the show where we get some feedback from you, the listener, in the form of questions that have been sent in via email or via one of our social media outlets. or perhaps someone's phoned up. We'll give you all the details on how to get in touch. We'll answer the questions that have been sent in this week, and then we'll decide on a winner of the best question, which wins an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So the first question is from Flipper, but spelled with a PH. So I'm not sure. That may be a nickname. I'm not sure. But Flipper says, our first 11 had four key members leave last season, and so we didn't win a game last year, and we were relegated to the next lower grade. We started this season with a win, but in our second game, we come up against a side who bowled with great discipline on the fourth stump line, and a lot of the guys really struggled to make any runs. The goal was to bat out the overs, 80 in a day, in this competition. But is that enough when you only post a low score and get all out before the end of the 80 overs? Is there a way to coach the players to look to make runs rather than just survive, or is it just a matter of self-confidence?
Well, it's a great question, and my initial response is that the batter's job in the main, in most situations, is to score runs. We've just seen a test match end over in the UAE where England effectively were just trying to bat out for a period of time. But that's a rare situation, particularly in the cricket that you're probably talking about here. It's something that you want to be doing is scoring runs, particularly in the first innings. Your aim is to score as many runs as you possibly can to then open up the game and give you options of winning the game in a different number of ways in multi-day cricket. But the England example, batting out 100 and whatever overs is a rarity, and it would be only then that I would be looking for somebody to bat like Adil Rashid did, for example, for 170 odd balls for 60 odd in that sort of context. So to me, it's about scoring runs. The other thing that I would say is that great information that you've given us, that when you come up against sides, or particularly a bowler that can bowl a very consistent line, you've got two ways of looking at it, I suppose. You've got the way that England always looked at playing against Glenn McGrath for many, many years, which was to just try and bat him out and see if you can make somebody else bowl where you can score off of them. And that was very much the way up until 2005. And then in 2005, probably through the thought processes of Vaughan and Fletcher, but more importantly, I think, was the impact that Kevin Peterson had in that series, was to use Glenn McGrath's consistency against him and to try and hit him off his length, or to try and set themselves up slightly differently so that consistency of length actually becomes an opportunity to score. So if you are against somebody who bowls a good consistent fourth stump line, one of the challenges that you've got there is that people lose their off stump, or they find scoring from that line through the offside is fraught with danger because it brings the slips into play, it brings the inside edge under the stumps into the play. And what a player like Peterson would do would be to say, right, if that guy's going to bowl it consistently on fourth stump, and that gives me an opportunity to move my stance across, or to move my pre-delivery movement across, so I can actually access that ball on both sides of a wicket rather than only hitting one side of a wicket, which is what England had done all the way through McGrath's career up until that point. So what you've got there is a positive way of looking at a situation where a bowler's bowling well, a fourth stump line. And instead of looking at it just to stay in, he's saying this is an opportunity for me to score both sides of the wicket and to put that pressure back on the opposition. The challenge we're playing against Australia all the way throughout those times was the fact that you had McGrath at one end and Warner at the other end, and the game would never go forward. And it was only really in 2005 where England found a way of making the game go forward against those two bowlers. And it meant that even if they only batted for 80 overs, as they did, for example, at Edgbaston, they scored 380, 408 runs in that innings, which then gave them opportunity to win the game in a couple of different ways. So I think whilst you've been relegated, it's given you an opportunity to recalibrate the way that you play. The next time you come up against that opposition, are there more positive ways that you can approach that 80 over period? And it might be that you get bowled out in 65 overs, but I bet your bottom dollar you'll get bowled out in 65 overs for a much bigger score than you got in your 72 that you played the other day, which then gives you more options as you go throughout that multi-day game of cricket.
Trying to find ways to score rather than hoping that you're going to get a bad ball is a very different mindset, isn't it, Lavers?
It is, and implementing it into a training session or a practice session, and encouraging people to do so is a tricky thing sometimes as a coach, or even if you're on a side and you don't have a coach there, so you've got to come up with ways of doing this yourself. I think you've always got an option now in a session where you can utilize some of the equipment we've talked about before to try and recreate the kind of situation you're going to find on a weekend. So if you're lucky enough to have a bowling machine to hand in a training session, you can maybe start to put the ball on that four stump line and almost have it as a bit of a creativity session for the guys and say, look, this is what we came up against last weekend. What can we do with it? It doesn't matter if we get out here trying to come up with something new. Let's try something that Gareth said there and try and either set up or trigger across to that slightly different four stump line, or let's try and move down the pitch, or let's try and use the depth of our crease or whatever it might be, and let's see if we can be creative and come up with something ourselves that works for us. And no doubt there'll be certain skills that work for some people and certain skills that work for others. So it's not necessarily going to be a one rule for all, but giving them that option to be creative in a session is a good starting point. The other thing you can do is you can use it as a tool for the bowlers as well, really, because no doubt the bowlers have sat there and watched and seen the benefit of that disciplined bowling as well. And maybe that can something be something you can pass over to them to try in a next session, where the bowlers are actually trying to hit that same disciplined line over and over again, so that once the guys have had their opportunity against a bowling machine or a throwdown or whatever it might be, they can then test themselves against the bowlers who are also challenging themselves to do the same thing that the opposition did in the previous week. So it can be a bit disheartening looking at it and thinking, where do we go? But a little bit of planning, a little bit of thinking about what you need to achieve, and you've probably got 3 weeks of practice there that you can use and hopefully make a bit of progress from.
And then is confidence a matter of doing the right preparation? And then so when you're walking out to the middle, you feel like, I've done this before, I can do it again, rather than how am I going to do this?
I think it's always a case of that, to be honest. And that's why Adil Rashid, for example, look at him last week, batting in a test match, getting almost there and then hitting one to cover. I'm sure that he's going to learn from that experience, and also learn from the experience of getting out, but also the experience of getting so close to achieving what would have been a phenomenal draw in Test cricket history. He'll take that forward. So yes, that's important. And then in practice, I think if you can set up your middle practice sessions to try and look at, say, a stage of that 80 over period and where you're looking to score before looking to defend. It could be the first 10 overs, it could be from overs 40 to 50, however you want to set it up, where you have a look at not just what runs you score in that middle practice, but also how many of those balls that you're looking to be proactive with, how many of those balls where you're looking to put the pressure back onto the bowler. And that can be maybe using that four stump line to walk down the wicket. It could be where the batter's trying to bat on middle and off as opposed to middle and leg, maybe to open up the leg side, and keep a tally of how many balls were breather balls, i.e. you're just letting the bowler do what he wants, and how many of those balls that you're looking to put the bowler under pressure. And even on the way back for the bowler walking back to the end of his mark, maybe ask him whether he felt as if the batter was trying to do something that ball or not, and then keep a log. And if you can get to the stage where all of a sudden you've got the bowler under pressure, or feel like the batter's trying to do something for 60% of the time, 70% of the time, then all of a sudden the game situation changes, and you know that you're changing behaviours around what was a tough situation where somebody was bowling consistently into a change of behaviour where you're beginning to be proactive, you're beginning to be more intentful when you're going around your batting business. Then over time, I'm sure you'll see some results happen when you go out and play in that situation again. Of course, next week you could come up against a bowling side that runs up and gives you a fair number of half volleys, but it would still be good to see that positive intent going through from this week into next week and beyond, because it will stand you in good stead.
Next question is from Johnny. And Johnny says, I'm having indoor nets at the moment, but the pitch is very bouncy. When a bowler bowls a good length ball, it often bounces much higher than it would in games. I found that I'm afraid to play forward in nets where I would need to do it in games. Is there any way I can gain confidence to play forward, even though I know this is much harder on the indoor pitch?
Well, this is horrible, isn't it? And this is what happens all the time. Well, not all the time, but a lot of the time when people go indoors, they see that the conditions are very, very different to what they're going to experience outside. And I think everyone's probably been in that situation in a sports hall where the surface is maybe a little bit livelier than they might encounter when they get into the conditions that they're actually preparing for. So, it's again, there it's probably about being creative and working out how you can make the situation simulate match conditions a little bit better, if that's what you're actually trying to achieve in that session. So it might be that you can use the session to be relevant to what you want to do, but I would say, first of all, think about how you can use the conditions to your advantage. So if you are using a mat, let's try and get a couple of mats down. Sometimes that works and that takes the sting out of things a little bit, and that makes the bounce a little bit less, but obviously that's taking a mat away from other use in the hall, so that's not something you can always do because not everyone will have enough mats to go around. So another drill we do sometimes is we challenge the bowlers a little bit by extending the length of the wicket, so they'll make them, we'll challenge them against the batsman over 24 yards rather than 22 yards. And that's another way that can take a little bit of sting and a little bit of the angle out of the bounce, even though that's not always the sort of overriding factor that's going to lead to it. Kind of thinking outside the box a little bit and trying to think differently about how you can change the conditions to make them a little bit more match realistic. If a match situation is what you're trying to create.
Great, yeah, great options that Sam's come up with there. The other thing, I don't think you can always change the pitch. It's great to have the capacity to change the pitch, but a lot of sports halls won't have mats that can go down. And then it's a down to, you're not going to ask the bowlers to run up and bowl half volleys all day long. So then you've got the option as a batter to adapt your technique. And again, that's something that's really good. And we see international teams having to do that because there aren't many pitches around the world that do bounce like an indoor sports hall. Historically Perth has, certainly the Nets do at the Wacker. Over the years, we've seen some examples of the ball bouncing a little bit more and batters not necessarily adapting particularly well. And then you go to somewhere like the Wanderers where the ball tends to go through and carries. And again, the same sort of thing happens and batters don't adapt. So to me, when you play indoors in these types of pitches, it is an opportunity to adapt. It is an opportunity to still try and challenge yourself to play forward off of those lengths. And it's an opportunity to play with slightly higher hands or to just allow the ball to come on a little bit more and to play it appropriately. Because at some stage in your career, whether you're playing international cricket or whether you're playing parts cricket, you will come across a pitch where the ball will bounce. And the best players on that given day and over the history of time will be the ones that can adapt. So I would encourage players, as well as doing the things that Sam said, I'd also encourage the batters to try and meet the expectation of a challenge that's in front of them as well. The other thing as well, which is really important to remember, is not just to try and counteract the bounce, but what you're learning to do is playing forwards of that type of delivery, is you're looking to try and reduce the distance that you can that the ball can deviate in. Because if we hang back on the crease and play that ball, whilst it might seem more comfortable for us to be able to do that, as soon as that ball deviates, we're allowing that distance to increase where the ball deviates, which is obviously then going to cause us some problems. So again, the best players are the ones that will find a way of going back into that ball and make contact slightly early with it, not by pushing their hands out in front of them, but playing a proper forward defensive off of that ball that's bouncing and maybe hitting higher up the bat than you'd normally expect. Those sort of things, again, are where the best players in the world challenge themselves rather than trying to find a sort of a diversion to get around that challenge. They meet that challenge head on and as a result, it makes them more adaptable when that situation does come up, whether it be, in an overseas tour that you might go on where the ball bounces a little bit more, or whether you end up playing. For example, we used to play games down at my club where it would rain and we'd go onto the artificial wicket, and the artificial wicket used to bounce more than any of the grass wickets. And some people would meet that challenge and some people would shirk that responsibility. And to me, every time you get in an indoor facility where it's flying through, it's an opportunity rather than something you want to try and get around. It's soapbox time, and it's David's go this week, so here's a minute on the clock. Over to you, David.
One of the things I've been thinking about recently is the difference between individuals and the team. Cricket is a team sport, clearly, but there's a lot of individual skills going on within it. I was talking to a player recently who's very individually focused. He likes to do what he wants to do. He knows what he needs to do to get the best from himself, and he isn't concerned about doing anything else. Sometimes that's at the detriment to his view of people, other people in the team, and other people's view of him in the team. So I was talking to him and trying to convince him a little bit more that even though it's very important to be able to work on the things that you want to work on, sometimes you have to do things that are for the good of the team rather than for the good of the individual. And when you're doing those things, you might not be directly improving yourself in any way. You might even think that it's a complete waste of time. But if you're doing those things and helping yourself become part of a unit and part of that team and working together, it's a very important part of your cricket development. And that is the end of the show for this week. There is one more quick thing we need to do before we go, and that is decide on the winner of this week's competition. The online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And we had Flipper's question about scoring rather than surviving. And we had Johnny's question about batting in indoor nets. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I'm going to go with Flipper's question. I thought it was some great detail that provided us with a good foundation for giving some answers. I think we answered it pretty well. His nickname reminds me of another Flipper that I know, which is Wayne Phillips, who was the Australian wicketkeeper back in 1985 and also a fine coach in his own right. So for that, Flipper, you are the winner this week.
Congratulations to you, Flipper. We do like a detailed question. And Gareth, if someone was listening in and they wanted their chance to win the prize and they wanted their question answered on the show, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. You can also get us on social media. Our Facebook is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. And you can find us on Twitter @pitchvisionacad. You can listen to this show every week. If you want to go to your favourite podcast app and do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you'll find us in there. Tap the subscribe button. And you'll get it sent to you every week. And if you want to stream the show from the website and get the show notes and get lots of other fun stuff, you can go to our website, which is pitchvision.com/academy. And then if you want to go into the podcast section, just click on the podcast link and you get all the show notes and the player for streaming on the web and all the rest of it. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, boys.
Thanks, guys.